Well, as always, I'll say Shabbat Shalom this morning.
Shabbat Shalom.
Kind of before we get started, I wanted to thank Crystalyn for leading our first Sabbath of the month discussion last week. She did a great job. I'm kind of hoping it inspired others to be able to take on that role. She just simply shared what she was studying herself and kind of walked us through that, and it was thought-provoking and meaningful to all of us. And like she showed us, you don't have to stand up here and, you know, put a message together. Just, you know, it's just all about sharing something that you're looking at that will create discussion. So, there's several weeks now to go before, you know, of course, first week in February. So I'm going to encourage someone who would like to take it next. Ah, Dylan. All right. Awesome. We got us one. I thought I was going to have to assign it, which I reserve the right to do if we don't get volunteers. So, all right. Well, great. We'll look forward to that. Since we had discussion week last week and we've had a new year come on us, this was the first time I got to write 2016. It seemed a little weird, as it always does. I don't know where 2015 went. It was just here and gone. Year end for me is like everybody else, you know, it's kind of a pain in the neck, right? We got to prepare for taxes and all that kind of stuff. And you know, I guess people have hated taxes for centuries, so it's nothing new. It certainly isn't for me. I definitely look forward to a time when we won't have taxes as they are now. I mean, tithes will take over and they'll be utilized in a righteous way, and they won't be wasted on government greed and corruption. But for now, we still have them, and to that end, I have prepared, as I always do, the year-end, summary statements for everybody to document the 2015 contributions. I'll set them right there, and everybody can pick those up after services. I very, very rarely, I think maybe only once, one other time, have I ever really even talked about money or tithes or anything like that. I think, in fact, it's been several years since I've even broached the subject here. But today I am going to take a few minutes here at the beginning to make a few comments. We all know that tithing is part of the Mosaic Law. It's not part of the Royal Law. And I've said many times that it's fascinating that there's some church leaders out there that are quick to state that the law is done away, but then they come at us with the law of tithing, and you really can't have it both ways. Indeed, there really is no 11th commandment, thou shalt pay 10% of your income to the church. Where we get tithing, obviously, is a principle. In Israel, there were 12 tribes, and God gave land to each one of those tribes that they could work, and they could put crops and raise livestock and stuff and create an increase each year. But there was two tribes that were given the responsibility to do all of the things that God was requiring of them in terms of sacrifices and the butchering of the bulls and the calves and, you know, all the ceremonial things. They would not have had time to do both. So they really had no way to create an increase or create, sustenance for them, for themselves, their family, and their tribe. So the other 10 tribes then made a tithe, a 10% that came into God's storehouse that then provided for those other two tribes to be able to do the duties, basically, of the entire nation. It wasn't just those two tribes that had the responsibility to do those things. They were acting on behalf of the whole nation. So in that way, God was, in a sense, kind of taxing the other tribes in order to provide for his government. within his nation, and that government was in serving the others. Now today, we've corrupted that. We have taxes that are paid to the government, but the government is really not serving in most cases. They're really serving themselves. But anyway, we don't want to get off on that money trail. In God's nation, though, he did provide for the people that did not get a regular portion. And they were to be servants to carry out those duties that the whole nation was responsible for. So that's really the principle of tithing. Now, we no longer have that same covenant. We know that. That covenant has been broken by those people. And so God abandoned it. He divorced them. So we no longer have to cover providing for bulls and goats to be slaughtered and all these ceremonial duties. But the principle is still there. The church body as a whole, like all of those 12 tribes, not just the two. See, the whole nation had this responsibility, not just the two. So if we equate that two to like the ministry and all of the tribes together, the 12, as the body or the church, we understand that it's the whole church, the whole body that has the responsibility to keep the law, including the Sabbaths, the high holy days. We were to, as a body, we are to help the widows and the fatherless and those that are in need. We have a great commission to preach the gospel to all the world and make disciples. See, we're not called just so that we can be saved. See, we're saved so that we can do the work of God. We're saved to be doers of the work. And with physical Israel, it was a lot of physical work. But with the church, with the spiritual body, it's now spiritual work. And God has given us this principle of tithing, this example, in order to provide for the resources to accomplish that work. And the difference is, and this is the beauty of it, is it, with Israel, he commanded them to do it. It was their duty. It was an obligation. And to those now that he calls in the Spirit, and he puts his Spirit, Christ comes and lives within us, he doesn't command it in that way. He wants it to come freely from the heart. So rather than an obligation, rather than this command, it's an opportunity to worship. It's an opportunity to receive blessing and the receipt of this great and powerful promise that we've looked at before in Malachi, where it says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you?" Well, the answer is in tithes and offerings. You haven't done it. And so you are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. He says, "Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house." Now, I know if I asked for a raise of hands here of who believed in tithing, every hand would go up. I know that. I think everyone here believes and understands that even though it's not a command or law, that in the context of belief in God, in belief in His sovereignty, in belief in His ability to be true to His promises, that we would want to do this. That it is a blessing. It is an act of worship that God promises He will honor. And we know that through the second part of this verse. It says, "Try me, test me. Put me to the test. Give it a shot, says the Lord. And see, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it." Tithing for us is not an act of law. It's an act of worship. It's an act of faith that God will indeed do what He says He will do. And to me, it's a no-brainer. I have done it so long that I know that mathematics does not work in this sense. 100 minus 10 doesn't equal 90. Somehow it equals 120 or 200 or something. I don't know how. It is a spiritual thing. And I've lived it for decades. I've tried it. It says, try me. Well, I did. I don't know how it works. And so far, I know that nothing I have said thus far is nothing more than a reminder, and there's no earth-shattering information here. On the subject of tithing, this is pretty much all I've really said about it over the years. And why? Why do I stop at that point? Because I know that I know in my heart that tithing is a blessing that comes from giving it freely. You see, if a pastor or an organization or something comes at this subject and it makes an obligation out of it, it tries to coerce or push people or make people feel guilty if they don't or whatever, and then those people tithe because of that, they miss the blessing. And so to me, why would I want to go there? Why would I want to try to push this to the point where people felt obligated and then miss out? So that's why I have always, always stopped short there. And all I've ever done is just say, this is a marvelous blessing. It's not a law. Because if it's a law, then you have to do it. And then it's not a blessing. It's not an act of worship. See? So we want to be able to... I want people to have that same thing, that act of worship, that blessing that comes from giving that tithe. And if I make it some legalistic burden, I do you disservice. Faithful, consistent application of tithing. Guys, even when it's hard, especially when it's hard, brings blessing. Over the years, I've come to see that 10%, that 10% is the most important part of my financial planning. I do it first. See, years ago, this thought occurred to me, and it's, I shouldn't say it occurred to me, it's blatant in the Bible, but it got a hold of me. That God has called me to be a first fruit. Do you realize that how many trillions of people or whatever have been born and died on this earth, and the fraction of people that are called to be a first fruit, to come up in that first resurrection, to follow Christ as the first fruit, is an amazing calling. It's a staggering thing. That we are a first fruit to be in that. And how fitting is that then? That we give our first fruit. You see, I don't tithe if I can afford it. I don't tithe after I've paid the bills. See that? It's just automatic. The increase comes in. It's automatic. It's, oh God, there's the first. It's first. It comes out before anything else. Because I'm a first fruit. And I get to give of my first fruit in response to that. You can't get that joy from that if it's a command, if it's an obligation. To me, maybe it is an obligation in my mind. I don't know, but it's very similar to, I have a command in the Bible that says, husbands, love your wives. I am commanded to love her. But that is a joyful obligation. Do I say, oh God, I gotta love you. Gotta pay that today. Okay, here's a kiss, babe. No. You see, because there's joy in that. There's blessing in that. Yeah, I'm commanded to do it, but I don't know. It's just similar. And there's a similar example in that. And when I say that, you know, you tithe first, you tithe whether you can afford it. Sometimes I can't afford it. Sometimes she's not very lovable. Sometimes I'm not very lovable. Sometimes it's not her that's not very lovable. Sometimes it's me that's just got a bad stinking attitude and I don't have the currency to do it. And I have to do it anyway. I pay it even when I can't afford it because I don't have that much of it in me. You see, it's kind of the same thing. I've had times in my walk with God, you guys all know this, where I didn't, if I did math to give my tithes, I wouldn't do it. And there were times where I said, you know what, I can't afford to do this. And I didn't. And I struggled. And then there was other times where I, you know, after knocking my head against the wall a few times, I thought, well, I can't afford it. Whether I pay it or not, I still can't pay my bills. So, hey, God, Malachi, I'll give this a try. You know, I'm just as hard-headed as the next guy. And then I did it, and somehow, some way, all the needs got met. It is a blessing. It is an honor as a first fruit to respond to God with our first fruits. Okay, why am I bringing this up this year? Why do this? Why is it on my mind? Well, y'all know, well, maybe some of you don't, that I don't personally take anything from these tithes or offerings that come in. I volunteer what I'm doing. I don't take anything from it. Fact is, I put into it. I sow into our body's storehouse. So I want you to understand as I make these next comments that I'm not making these comments from any sort of personal advantage whatsoever. There's no financial motivation for me at all. The motivation, the reason that I'm making these comments is because I am compelled after thinking about this, putting those together, thinking through this at the end of this year to instill some of this blessing into this body. And so I'm making these comments only in context of the health of the body. I want to make sure that everybody is gaining the tremendous benefit that comes as this, as you experience this act of worship. And I want this promise for our body. Not just for me individually, but for our body. Right? So that we can move forward and do the work that we're called to do. Now, understand. I put these together. When I do, I don't have, you know, I can do math. I know what 10% of somebody's income is. But I don't know what your incomes are. I don't want to know. Don't care to know. I also have no clue whatsoever where tithes go that don't come into here. So understand, this is not me looking at these numbers and judging whether or not somebody's tithing or not. A, I have no idea what your income is, and B, I have no idea what you paid elsewhere. So it's not about that at all. And I want to make that completely clear, okay? Quite frankly, this is why I've never even broached this subject in the past, because I assume that if your tithes and offerings are not coming in here, that they're going somewhere else. Because I know you guys. That's kind of the point that I want to make today. What I want to address has everything to do with what I just said. That I assume that if the tithes and offerings aren't coming in here, they're going elsewhere. So because I know that you guys believe in it, as I've just outlined here, I'm assuming that many of you, some of you, are doing their own distributions of tithes outside of our body. And probably because you know that I don't take anything, that we don't have needs for an expensive hall, and you know, we don't have a lot of big expenses. And that's fine. I don't take any sort of salary, but that's not all that the tithes are for. See, we use these for keeping the weekly Sabbath. We have some expenses each week, very little. We use them to keep the annual Sabbaths. We have expenses. And I have always focused in this group on spiritual growth, not numbers. But the numbers are growing. And at some point in time, probably pretty quickly, if we have much more at all, we're going to outgrow this space. And we're going to need to go somewhere. And the question is there going to be enough in God's storehouse to provide for that? It's a question. We have a responsibility as a body to feed the hungry, the widows, the fatherless. We have a responsibility to preach the gospel, to make disciples. And whether we address some of those things by engaging with other organizations or doing it ourselves, as a body, we have that responsibility. And the question is, will we have the resources to do it? And again, I think that because I choose to donate my time rather than take any support, that some feel like they should just point their tithes elsewhere. But I want to consider, you know, verse 10 again. And that is this: bring all the tithes into the storehouse, it says. It says to bring them into the storehouse, into my house, that there may be food there. So where are the tithes for this body to go is my question for today. And maybe we talk about it during our discussion. But where should they go? And I present that I think they should go into God's storehouse for this body. Now, I know that there are a great many things that I've heard a lot of us that do, maybe with our tithes. And I'm not saying we don't do that, but what I am saying is that we should do it as a body. You know, there's things that I have donated to and that we do compassion, we do wounded warrior, we do all these different things. But what I have done is I've said, no, I bring that into God's storehouse. And then we can do those things as a body. Now, why? Why did this come on my mind? Because it seems to me that there is greater wisdom and there is greater power in the body directing those resources rather than individuals, me included, to do that, to decide how, as a body, that we are going to use God's provisions, because they're God's provisions when we put them in there. And so I personally think that we should bring the tithes, as it says, first into God's storehouse, and then as a body determine how to use them for His glory. And you know, because we don't pay a pastor, because we don't have a building to support at this point in time, we have a tremendous ability to do a lot with those funds very efficiently. And I invite everybody to be, as members of that body, a part of that process. Many of the things that you guys might be individually supporting, we can do that as a body. And probably, because we are, you know, this, I believe that maybe there is a double blessing to this. Okay, God tells us to do this, and He says to us individually, hey, watch that I won't just, you know, make it overflow and all of that. And I think maybe there's a double blessing. Are we missing out on some double blessing? By not only us individually receiving this blessing, but as a body receiving that blessing. That we could sow into it first, as God tells us to do, and then as a body see God open the windows of heaven and pour out a blessing on this body. See, I know it works individually. I've done it. Him doing it. Have done it for years and years and decades. And because God says specifically to bring it into His storehouse, I just can't help but think that there is some possible double blessing that we're missing out on because we are just individually doing this. And that's my thoughts. I mean, I'm not going to belabor it. I just want our worship to be genuine and from the heart. And like it or not, how we treat our resources is part of that worship. And I don't talk about it a lot, but after all, that is what it is. It's an act of worship. You know, we came in this world with nothing. We're going to leave with nothing in a physical sense. And money does not have to be some taboo subject that we avoid. And I hope I explained why I have avoided in the past. Only because I want you guys to have the blessing of it and not have an obligation. I want us to be able to come together and be able to honor and glorify God in worship in that way as well. And so we can talk about it when we circle up. All right. Onward, back to the red letters. As you'll recall, we left off with Yeshua having, of course, ridden into Jerusalem on a donkey, and with all that fanfare, we saw him return to the city and be confronted by the scribes and the Pharisees and their questioning of him and their desire to discredit him. We have seen our hero, Yeshua, kind of proceed to rip them to shreds and put them in their place. And basically, I guess the score at this point is what, about a zillion to zero? Our next words of Christ that we want to look at is in Matthew 22 and verses 35 through 40. Then one of them, a lawyer, he's a scribe, asked him a question, testing him, saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" And Yeshua said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." Now, we've discussed before how it is that many try to say that the times that Christ and Paul and others and Peter referred to the law, that they were not referring to the Ten Commandments, but rather referring to this statement as some sort of new law. But we know that Christ said that law that was not done away was a law that was written with jots and tittles. So is this a new law? Are we released from the Ten Commandments, and it's just up to us now to determine how it is that we're to love God and love neighbor? Are we free to decide how to extend that love and what that looks like? Are we down to just two commandments now? Is this the new covenant law? Well, no. No, 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 and no. Right? First off, note in 36 here that the question is, what is the greatest in the law? Even the guy questioning him is not asking about a new law. He's directly referring to an existing law. So we have to ask ourselves, well, what law is he referring to? What law is being asked about? Is it the entirety of law? In other words, the Mosaic law, the Ten Commandments, the Talmud, the Mishnah, all the verbal laws? And out of all of that, what is the greatest? Is that his question? He could be asking that. See, we don't know. See, remember, in Hebrew, they had all these different words for law, but when we get to Greek, we only have one. So he probably said he might have been referring to the whole law. He might have been referring to just one part of it. But we don't know for sure. I say we get some pretty good hints here later. But regardless of how the question was asked, the answer Yeshua gives centers only on His law, the law that He wrote with His own hand. And our first glimpse at knowing this comes from the coverage of this same interaction by Mark over here in chapter 12. Here we have Mark's account of Yeshua's answer to the same question. Verses 30 and 31 are basically the same as Matthew. That the first is to love God and the second is to love neighbor as yourself. But I want to draw your attention to verse 29 where Yeshua said, "The first of all commandments is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." So whether the scribe was inquiring about all the laws or just the Ten Commandments, it doesn't really matter. When asked about what is the greatest law, Yeshua went straight to His own law. Now, why do I say that? Do you guys remember back a couple of years ago when we went through the series on the Ten Commandments? And at the very beginning of that series, you guys got a little frustrated with me because I started talking about the fact that the first commandment was not the first commandment. And we had this discussion about the numbering. Remember that? And I showed you that the numbering that we have now, that we how we number them, is not the same as the Jews numbered them. The fact is, God never numbered them. Man numbered them. And they've been numbered a few different ways. Today, in Christendom, people ignore this preamble. See, God gave His law and He began to speak. And we call that first little part that He spoke, that first sentence, a preamble. We don't call it a law. We start with, have no other gods before me as number one. They didn't do that. This was the first thing He spoke, and that was the first thing that they said, that's the first law. Now, this is a Hebrew idiom, a reference to that, when He says, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He's referring in, the Hebrews had this statement that referred to God being the I Am. The one God. And when you look up the Ten Commandments, the first thing that God says is, I am. And so, that's why when we look at this, and we say, Yeshua answered him and said, the first of all the commandments is, I am God. I'm God. That's how the Jews looked at it. That's how Yeshua looked at it. He's referring to His law. Now, the Jews still have 10. Why? Because they take that. This is actually the first one. The second commandment is, have no other gods before me and don't have idols. That part is number two. Whereas Christendom breaks those apart as one and two, and we still come up with 10. Of course, the Catholics, they had to get rid of idols and do some other jacking around. So their numbering is completely different because they had to do away with some commandments. But that's a different subject. The point here is that when this scribe asked Yeshua, what is the greatest in the law? He says, okay, well, the first part of my law, the first commandment is, I am. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He is one. Okay, that was the first commandment to him. All right? Because according to Christ, that's it. It's not a preamble. And so the point is that in answering what is this greatest commandment, he immediately goes to refer to his law, the first commandment. And then he moves on. And so he answered the question about the law by directing the scribe right back to the law that matters. Right? The one that he wrote with his own hand. So verse 29 is actually referring in the language and understanding of their day to the actual first commandment. And so then after that, he speaks a Hebrew idiom. And he says that, you know, to love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. This was an idiom that was used routinely in Hebrew. Instead of saying all of the commandments, they boiled the commandments down to those two sections, because we know the first part of the royal law is all about what? Recognizing God as the one true God, as not having idols, as not worshiping Him and taking on a relationship with Him and not listening to Him, being vain about it, making it worthless, keeping His Sabbath, instructions about how to love the Lord God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And then instructions in the back part about how we love our neighbor. In not lying to them or stealing from them or whatever. And for any that believe that Christ here was giving some sort of a new commandment, you should point them to Deuteronomy chapter 6 and Leviticus 19. See, here we see it. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. This was nothing new. You shall love the Lord God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength. Leviticus 19, you shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. These statements were nothing new. Christ, as Yahweh, had said them long before he restated them to these scribes. So by this time, they had become this well-known idiom. And so it was just a summation. That doesn't mean that these replace the law. It means that if you do those two things, then you have fulfilled the law. See, you can't lie and cheat and steal and murder and be loving your neighbor. You just can't do it. You can't have other gods. You can't have idols. You can't worship in vain and really be loving God with all your heart, soul, and mind, can you? It's a summation. So I think we have some discussion points around this. So here's some questions for us. What did Christ mean in Matthew 22 that on these two commandments hang? What's it mean by that? What's it mean that hangs, that these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets? Does it do away with them? Mark 20, 30. We'll look at that. We'll see that it starts with the word and. After he said, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one," he says and he goes into that Hebrew idiom. Does this mean that he's adding something? What's he saying? We're going to read Mark 12, 32 through 34. This is a passage after what we just read. And I want to see what additional insights or perspective that we can gain from that. All right, let's look at the last section here of Matthew 22. So after astonishing everyone with his answers, Yeshua finally gets around to asking them a question. And so through all of their questions, he's kind of put them in their place, and now he's going to put himself in his place. So let's check this out. Matthew 22, 41 through 46. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Yeshua asked them, saying, "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" They said to him, "The son of David." He said to them, "How then does David in the Spirit call him Lord? Saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool.'" And then Yeshua asks this question, if David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? No one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day on did anyone dare question him anymore. It's interesting that Yeshua addressed the Pharisees when they were together. Verse 41, he took them all on at once. With all their collective so-called wisdom and understanding, none was able to answer him a word. It shut them up completely. In Mark, we see, when we read this section there, he adds that all the common people heard him gladly. Now, I'm sure these Pharisees didn't. Because, see, unlike the Pharisees that were asking these questions to ensnare him, Yeshua didn't ask this question to ensnare them. He didn't ask it to be prideful that he could ask something they couldn't answer. He was lovingly trying to teach them something. Had they opened their ears to hear, they would have garnered a great truth. The first question was, whose son is the Christ? Now remember, Christ is not the name of Yeshua. When we use that word, it's why I use Yeshua. Because Christ means Messiah. You know, that's what it is. He is the Christ. That's why it says, what do you think about the Christ? What do you think about the Messiah? And so immediately when they asked that, then they probably thought of scriptures like this in Psalm. Once I have sworn by my holiness, I will not lie to David. His seed shall endure forever, his throne as the sun before me. Or Isaiah, the increase of his government, and peace there will be no end upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to order it and establish it with justice and judgment. Kind of backwards there, from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. It's very clear in the scriptures, and they knew the scriptures, what the answer to that first question was. You know, whose son will the Messiah be? That's the easy one. It's David's son. They were looking for a king to come from the line of David. So they answered this question, and there was no doubt about it. The Messiah comes from David. But once he had that established from them, then the deep question came. The one that they could not or did not want to answer. And that was, if David then calls him Lord, how is he his son? So there's lots of implications to this. And as you kind of break this down and look at it. And I want to do this together. So here's a few questions to get it going. It says David was in the Spirit when he called the Messiah Lord. Now, what impact does that have to this passage? What message or what teaching was Yeshua giving to these Pharisees? What did they either not understand or did understand and didn't like? Okay? And lastly, why did the common people hear it with gladness? So, and we can come up with some other questions too. But that's our questions for today. So, let's go ahead and circle up and discuss this. And I will also say that if we have questions about, you know, the tithing thing that I started with, we can talk about that too. So.